Good morning, Excellencies. It's not on yet. The Deputy Secretary General, ladies and gentlemen, I, as a Director General of the International Development Law Organization, it gives me great pleasure to welcome you to the first panel discussion of the high-level event of the General Assembly on the contributions of human rights and the rule of law in the post-2015 development agenda. And this panel discussion will focus on exploring the contributions that human rights and the rule of law make to supporting national and international efforts towards poverty eradication and sustainable development. We have the privilege to have with us here Mr. Jan Eliasson, the Deputy Secretary General, as the keynote speaker. And I would like to start by giving him the floor.
Excellencies, ladies and gentlemen, first of all, many thanks to our moderator, Mrs. Irene Khan, Director General of the International Development Law Organization. We look forward to your able guiding of this morning's discussions. And I'm also delighted to welcome my friend and predecessor, as Deputy Secretary General, the Honorable Asha Rose Migiro, Minister of Justice and Constitutional Affairs of Tanzania, along with the other distinguished panelists and discussants at my side. Excellencies, ladies and gentlemen, in the Millennium Declaration of 2000, the world leaders recognized that we have a collective responsibility to uphold the principles of human dignity, equality, and equity. The leaders promised to spare no effort to promote democracy and strengthen the rule of law, as well as respect for human rights and fundamental freedoms, including the right to development. Progress has been made in achieving the MDGs. However, there are new challenges to our development agenda. Inequality is on the rise. Conflicts have not abated and are increasingly complex, with growing ethnic and sectarian elements, as well as being exacerbated by terrorism and organized crime. We are seeing strains on our natural resources and the effects of climate change. Popular discontent and vulnerability trigger widespread social unrest and violence in today's world, as we all know. The MDGs have demonstrated that our sustainable development efforts could have been enhanced by stronger emphasis on the rule of law and well-functioning institutions. Today's discussion is a valuable opportunity to assess how human rights and the rule of law have contributed and could contribute, and I hope will contribute, to sustainable development. Excellencies, ladies and gentlemen, all human rights, civil, political, economic, and social, are, as we all know, indivisible, interdependent, and mutually reinforcing. The new development agenda will have to reflect the freedom from want and the freedom from fear. Each part of the agenda will have to be underpinned by existing human rights obligations. Human rights norms should be instrumental in the formulation of goals, targets, and indicators. We now have an opportunity to join forces behind a transformative agenda for sustainable development. Human rights are central to many of the necessary transformative shifts. Let me briefly elaborate on a few core human rights principles which provide this transformational power. First, non-discrimination and equality. Two, participation. And three, accountability. First, the twin principles of non-discrimination and equality are fundamental elements of human rights law. They direct our attention to those who need our support, the most vulnerable, the poorest, and the most marginalized. They call for reorienting our strategy to address the structures which sustain discrimination and poverty. These principles demand that, in a time and in an environment of limited resources, those most in need are to be given priority. The second principle is participation. People are the best drivers of their own development. active and informed participation in decision-making at all levels produces not only better strategies, but an ownership of the results. This requires access to information, freedom of expression, of assembly, and of association. Clear legal frameworks, strong institutions, and transparency form the basis of the third principle, accountability. Development is a right and a shared responsibility. We need well-functioning, accessible, and accountable institutions at the international and national levels to realize the right to development. Excellencies, ladies and gentlemen, there is a growing understanding, as reflected in the Rio Plus document, that rule of law is essential to ensuring sustainable progress in economic, environmental, and social development. Member States are currently considering how to reflect the rule of law in the post-2015 agenda. Let me briefly address some concrete aspects of the rule of law, which are drivers of development. The elements of the rule of law, for instance, the ones that were decided on the 25th of September 2012, are not abstract concepts. They relate to legal frameworks anchored in human rights standards. They support enforceable contracts and fair labor regulations, which are required for equitable and inclusive growth. Rule of law requires that all persons have a legal identity. It is needed to claim equal rights and to have access to public services, information, and justice. For example, in Angola and Egypt, UNICEF has worked with national and local authorities to help issue identity cards. There are so many people who simply do not exist formally. Together with civil society, UNICEF and the government have created mechanisms to reach, in particular, women and marginalized groups. The rule of law provides mechanisms for holding public officials accountable to their constituencies. Accountability is essential to prevent the arbitrary exercise of power and to provide the stability and predictability required for development. For instance, this year, China adopted a policy to enhance accountability for the implementation of environmental regulations. Companies are required to install monitoring equipment and to publicly disclose the emission of pollutants. By this, industries know what to expect, and public servants are less likely to disregard non-compliance. The rule of law also means independent and effective justice systems which protect people's rights. The groundbreaking work of the Commission on Legal Empowerment of the Poor showed us how important the rule of law is in enabling people to lift themselves out of poverty. In Cambodia, a project called Public Interest Legal Advocacy has helped communities to assert their rights to land through collective judicial actions against illegal land seizures. This project allowed many Cambodian families to reach settlements for the use of their land. The rule of law also supports effective security systems and institutions. Violence, conflict, and crime undermine development. In Guatemala, the International Commission Against Impunity has helped to address organized crime and strengthen national institutions. It has contributed towards the disbandment of illegal groups and strengthened the national justice system to tackle these groups in the future. Institutions can and should also combat corruption, which erodes the resources needed for sustainable development. It has been estimated that every year the developing world loses an appalling $1 trillion in illicit outflows through corruption, criminal activity, and tax evasion. Only for Africa, former President Thabo Mbeki has led a commission which concluded that $50 billion flows out illicitly out of Africa every year. Excellencies, ladies and gentlemen, there has been a discussion on how to measure impact and progress in the area of rule of law. International and regional organizations have developed credible measurements methods on land and property security, corruption, justice, human trafficking, violence against women and girls, birth registration, and access to services information, progress has been made in finding measurable rule of law elements. Countries are increasingly measuring the rule of law for use in national policy planning. Timely and reliable statistics help decision makers and ensure that policies are evidence-based, and this in turn supports resource mobilization, transparency, and accountability. Integrated rule of law in the post-2015 development agenda would foster this virtuous cycle and enhance stability of our efforts. Finally, on the important principle of universality, let us remember that this is an organization of almost 200 member states. The development challenge of individual countries vary widely. Our national experience are deeply rooted in history, as well as in political and legal systems. However, our aspirations for the well-being, security, and justice in our families and in our communities are universal. And as affirmed by the General Assembly, the rule of law has common features founded on international norms and standards. And universally agreed norms can guide us towards a transformative and universal agenda. And I'm sure that if you all look into your nation's history, you will find that institutions have played an important role in progress in all areas, political, economic, social. Finally, Excellencies and Gentlemen, let me close by quoting a certain Tanzanian former law professor. As Deputy Secretary General Asha Rose Migiro once said, the rule of law and human rights deserve our support because they foster development. But they also demand our support in their own right as a matter of simple justice. As a matter of simple justice. I fully agree with my distinguished predecessor, and I look forward to her views and those of all of our distinguished panelists here today. Thank you, Madam Moderator.
Thank you, Mr. Deputy Secretary General, for your very succinct and strong remarks, pulling out the value that human rights and rule of law bring to development, and particularly focusing on concrete example of how governments are incorporating rule of law in their development strategies. Let me now say a few words about human rights and the rule of law. We cannot eradicate poverty or promote sustainable development or create inclusive economies when human rights are ignored, when the rule of law is absent, when justice and accountability systems do not function properly, when poor people are not able to participate in decisions that affect their lives and livelihoods, when women and minorities suffer from discrimination, when opportunities are open only to the few based on wealth and privilege, when corruption and bribery distort access to basic services. Poverty is not just about low income. It is actually about the denial of human rights, the right to housing, health, decent work, the right to information, the right to participation. In short, the entire gamut of economic, social, and cultural rights, and civil and political rights. The value of human rights to development is multifaceted. First, human rights teach us to focus on the human being, on the impact on people's lives, not on how fast the economy is growing, but whether there are decent jobs for people, not on whether school buildings have been built, but whether girls have equal access to education as boys, not on whether agricultural production has gone up only, but also whether people have enough to eat. Human rights expose inequalities and injustices. They're not about the aggregate, but about the individual, about who is being left behind and why. Human rights are an empowering process. By asserting their rights, the poor place themselves at the center of the debate on development and gain dignity. And finally, human rights are an accountability framework. Human rights and the rule of law have a symbiotic relationship. Without respect for human rights and the rule of law, we will fail to make development work for everyone. We will fail to prioritize those who are being left behind. Good laws and effective institutions can transform societies, especially when they're accompanied by the empowerment of citizens and the full participation of civil society. So the rule of law, properly understood, provides not only certainty and predictability, but also substantive justice. Seen in this way, it is fundamental to all three dimensions of sustainable development. It provides for predictability and certainty that is key to economic development. It promotes social development by ensuring equal opportunity and equitable access, and by strengthening the legal framework to protect the environment, it ensures the environmental dimension of development. 15 years ago, the Millennium Declaration recognized the importance of human rights and the rule of law to development. Across the world, in countries across the spectrum of development, from lawmaking and policy setting to execution on the ground, from the global to the grassroots level, we have seen how people, prosperity, and the planet have suffered when human rights and the rule of law have been ignored. But we have also seen the breakthroughs that have come when rights are upheld, when institutions work effectively, when the rule of law is respected. And today, we are privileged to have with us a very distinguished panel who will share with us their views and experience on the relevance and challenge of integrating human rights and the rule of law in poverty eradication and sustainable development. We do not underestimate the challenges. We do not underestimate the controversies that are involved. But we hope that this panel will help to contribute to forging consensus around the priorities and set the stage for what the Deputy Secretary General has said we are all aspiring to, and that is a truly transformative agenda post-2015 for sustainable development. And now I would like to invite the panelists. Let me start first with the Honourable Dr. Asha Rose Mijiro, the Minister of Justice and Constitutional Affairs of Tanzania.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. I should start by saying that it is for me a great pleasure to be back in these halls and to meet old friends and colleagues once again. I believe that the discussion on the contributions of human rights and the rule of law in the post-2015 development agenda is an important dialogue we ought to have, we must have. Madam Chair, I'm privileged to be part of this discussion with such distinguished panelists. I'm particularly delighted that my successor and friend, Deputy Secretary General Jan Eliasson, is the keynote speaker this morning. Madam Chair, my passion for this subject is well known. As the DSG has said, I have worked in this area as a law professor and a legal practitioner. I also had the privilege to chair the Rule of Law Coordination and Resource Group in my capacity then as Deputy Secretary General. I'm very, very happy, and I learned this yesterday happily, that my successor, Mr. Eliasson, is doing a great job. Thank you very much for your leadership in this work. And I know you're doing it with new vigor and new energy. Thank you very much. In my current position as Minister for Constitutional and Legal Affairs, I have dealt with the subject of human rights and the rule of law in its various dimensions. It is therefore opportune that today we are discussing the need to appreciate and strengthen the nexus between sustainable development, human rights, and the rule of law. And I want to fully support what Madam Chair has said, the connection between these subjects and development and their role in the post-2015 development agenda. Madam Chair, since September 2000, when the MDGs were adopted here in New York, notable progress has been made. Many countries, especially those with huge development challenges, have aligned their policies and priorities with the implementation of the MDGs. We have witnessed concerted efforts at national and international levels to place the MDGs at the center of the development agenda. While good progress has been recorded, a lot more remains to be done. In my own country, Tanzania, key targets in some of the MDGs are within reach. But the challenge we face is addressing the gap between rural and urban settings and ensure that all citizens have equal and equitable enjoyment of the benefits of sustainable development. I believe there are a lot more countries that are facing this challenge. Rural-urban disparities are one area, but in the course of implementing the MDGs, other gaps became notable as well. It is undisputed that human rights and the rule of law are key enablers for development, and both the DSG and Madam Chair have alluded to this. It will be recalled that these two were not set as specific goals, but we all know that the content of the MDGs is about human rights, it's about rule of law, it's about transparency, it's about accountability. And these are indeed an important component of sustainable development. As we count down to the target date, we have to give full effect to the 2013 General Assembly outcome document that the post-2015 development agenda be inclusive, people-oriented, with goals that are universal and applicable to all countries. It is unacceptable, for instance, that around 4 billion people are excluded from the rule of law. 7 out of every 10 children in the least developed countries are without birth certificates. This is about their identity, it's about their human rights, it's about their existence. In some countries, the proportion of judges to the population stands at 1 per million people. Yet in other countries, the bitter reality is that millions of people continue to be discriminated based on race, ethnicity, religion, and sex. All these, Madam Chair, make it critically important that promotion of human rights and the rule of law be at the core of the post-2015 development agenda. Adherence to and full realization of human rights and rule of law at national, regional, and international levels is a sine qua non for meaningful and sustainable development. The post-2015 development agenda should therefore seek to empower the most vulnerable in our countries, the marginalized, women and girls, the elderly, persons with disabilities, and those with special needs. We should work to close the gap between rural and urban areas. All sections of communities should be empowered to have unhindered access to justice, property rights, including the right to own and inherit land, labor rights with equal pay for equal work. In this regard, it is key that human rights and the rule of law are the centerpiece of the post-2015 development agenda, and equally so for sustainable development goals. The discussion on rule of law must also consider the international dimension. We noted in the 2012 high-level meeting on the rule of law that good governance at the international level is fundamental for strengthening rule of law. In this regard, we must intensify our efforts to revitalize the General Assembly and work towards reforming the Security Council and the Bretton Woods institutions. The goal should be to better reflect realities of the day and enhance the voice and participation of developing countries. We surely need capable global institutions for advancing the post-2015 development agenda. Permit me to close by calling for continued effort to promote international cooperation and partnerships, especially in rendering technical assistance and building capacities for countries in need. I wish to recognize the Secretariat, the leadership of the Secretary General, and the UN agencies for their commitment in this regard. We have seen firsthand how beneficial such support has been for countries in post-conflict situations, especially in rebuilding their state institutions, including through security sector reform. Such assistance would be crucial in the post-2015 development agenda. Let me now end by wishing all of us fruitful deliberations. Thank you very much for your kind attention.
Thank you, Madam Minister, for making a passionate and strong statement for human rights and rule of law as the centerpiece of development, and for pointing out the importance of the rule of law at the international level. May I now invite Mr. Christoph Stresser, the Federal Government Commissioner for Human Rights Policy and Humanitarian Aid of Germany, to take the floor.
Madam Chair, Excellencies, ladies and gentlemen, it's a great pleasure for me and a big honor to participate in this event on contributions of human rights and the rule of law in the post-2015 development agenda. And I wish to thank the PGA for organizing this series of high-level events on a topic so highly relevant to the future development agenda. The goal we want to achieve with the post-2015 agenda is clear: to allow every person in the world to live a life in dignity free from fear and want. Traditional perspectives on development tend to focus on a narrow view of development as economic development. Yet development is far more than that. It includes a person's ability to effectively influence his or her fate by voicing his or her concerns and being heard by those in power with regard to those concerns. Germany, like many other stakeholders, is convinced that the answer to this challenge lies in putting human rights in the center of the post-2015 development agenda by adopting a human rights-based approach to development, reflecting the full range of civil, political, economic, social, and cultural rights, and a strong commitment to the rule of law. The advantage of such an approach is clear. Recognizing human rights implies that there are right holders and duty bearers. This fosters accountability on the side of public authorities and empowerment on the side of individuals. Existing human rights structures, such as national human rights institutions, can play an important part in this regard. However, adopting such a human rights-based approach can seem challenging, as it represents a paradigm shift in the way we view both development cooperation and human rights. This paradigm shift does not constitute an unreasonable expectation. The vast majority of states have accepted universal, indivisible, and interrelated human rights obligations under international law. In turn, the universality of human rights makes them the ideal starting point for a universal development agenda, not least by providing legitimacy to development goals by connecting them to existing legal obligation from human rights treaties. It is therefore important that we remain assertive in our request that human rights find their adequate reflection in any future development agenda, as well as credible by ensuring the realization of human rights of all persons within our own countries. In addition to requiring a profound change in the way we address things, determining how to design and implement measures in accordance with human rights law can appear daunting even to the most willing of actors. What measures can legitimately be prioritized in a context of very limited resources? How can participation take place in practice, in particular in societies where the mere distribution of information can prove challenging? Of course, the answers to these questions are always context-based, and there are no one-size-fits-all solutions. Fortunately, the international human rights framework provides us with some clear requirements, as well as considerable amount of flexibility of the framework beyond these requirements. The hardcore of any human rights-based approach is that the design and implementation of measures must be guided by the principles and standards derived from international human rights treaties at all times. As a consequence, any encroachment on a human right requires proper justification, subject to verification in accordance with the rule of law. Like the development framework, human rights demand for transparent monitoring and provide a set of minimum requirements that such monitoring has to fulfill. These requirements can contribute to shaping potential new targets and indicators of sustainable development. Moreover, the human rights framework includes a set of principles which can provide useful guidance in the design of targets and indicators to measure the achievement of goals. Among these are the principles of equality and non-discrimination, can provide useful guidance on how to adequately prioritize resources to realize the human rights of all individuals. This is especially relevant where the fulfillment of the MDGs has not reached large parts of the population. In those cases, new resources must therefore be allocated in priority to individuals belonging to vulnerable and otherwise marginalized groups in society on the basis of adequately disaggregated data. Furthermore, the principle of non-retrogression implies that states have the obligation to maintain human rights standards once attained. This principle already finds its reflection in the universal claim for sustainability, which has proven a major concern over the past years. At the same time, the principle of progressive realization with regard to economic, social, and cultural rights ensure that states' obligations are defined by and limited to by what they can provide with the means they have. There are many more aspects to consider in this context, and I look forward to hearing your perspective on the issue. Let us translate our conviction: the post-2015 framework must be guided by human rights into action and made freedom from want and fear for all people without discrimination a reality. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you, Mr. Strasser, for pointing out that the universality of human rights provide a basis for a universal development agenda and for indicating how the human rights framework can actually help in setting targets and indicators for the sustainable development goals. May I now call upon Mr. Martin Kreutner, the Dean of the International Anti-Corruption Academy.
Madam Chairperson, Excellencies, ladies and gentlemen, dear colleagues and friends, I am most honored to be here with you today, having had the opportunity to listen and discuss with many of you the important topics surrounding the post-2015 development agenda. The challenges facing us have changed in the course of globalization, but the devastating effects of corruption have remained. Let us recall that, from a global perspective, a staggering two-digit percentage of GDP's wealth are constantly and continuously siphoned away into illegitimate corrupt channels. And we've been hearing from the DGS, Mr. Ellison, just before, that as far as the African region is concerned, it totals up to more than $1 billion every single year. It is impossible to look to corruption through any lens and miss the intrinsic link to human rights and development. In a study by the global think tank Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, published only 4 days ago, it reads, and I quote, "Acute corruption should be understood not as a failure of government, but as a functioning system in which ruling networks use selected levers of powers to capture specific revenue streams. Such systematic corruption evokes indignation in populations, making it a factor in social unrest and insurgency. It contributes to other international security threats, such as symbiotic relationships between states and transnational organized crime networks, facilitation for terrorist organizations, international security regimes, and economic disruptions. Corruption combines with other risk factors to increase the likelihood of a security challenge," unquote. Let us all be reminded that many national and regional conflicts and uprisings of the recent past, including the Arab Spring movement and development in the Ukraine, have been triggered or were at least supported by the level of corruption that the respective populace was no longer ready to accept. Excellencies, ladies and gentlemen, the global economic crisis has further undermined trust in government and institutions. According to a study by the OECD, only 4 out of 10 citizens in OECD countries today state that they have confidence in their national authorities. Furthermore, the global NGO Transparency International, with its global corruption barometer, a survey conducted in more than 100 countries, found out that 6 out of 10 interviewees believe that corruption has increased in the recent 3 years. What is more, 54% of all contenders think that their government is largely or entirely run by groups acting in their own interests rather than for the benefit of the citizens. The executive branch and the legislative, to be closely followed by the judiciary and the media, are generally perceived to be among the institutions being the most prone to corruption. It is these powers, however, that our concept of the modern state of democracy is being based on. Governments and political institutions must therefore find ways to demonstrate and improve their reliability, accountability, and ultimately even legitimacy vis-à-vis concerns of the citizens. To fill the gaps and accelerate progress, we need renewed global commitment and greater collective action among all sectors of society. The MDGs are our promise to those less privileged to do all we can to achieve to elevate their suffering. As Desmond Tutu once said, quote, "Do your little bit of good where you are. It is those little bits of good put together that overwhelm the world," unquote. The MDGs have rendered mixed results, but as the Secretary General rightly pointed out in his report, A Life of Dignity for All of August last year, we have nevertheless made remarkable progress. The target of halving the percentage of people suffering from hunger by 2015 is within reach, so the SG. As we embark towards the post-2015 era and build on commitments made in Rio, we must not get distracted in finishing what we started. Still, we can end extreme poverty within a generation. There is growing awareness of corruption's intertwined nature. The multitude of international legal instruments at our disposals, private-public partnership, and the efforts for robust action. I would like to particularly commend the United Nations Convention Against Corruption, UNCAC, and its 2009 achievement of implementing a state-owned review mechanism. The important fourth evaluation round of GRECO, the Group of States Against Corruption of the Council of Europe, the supply-side-oriented OECD anti-bribery convention, as well as the recent declaration of the Global Organization of Parliamentarians Against Corruption, COPAC, adopted in the framework of the fifth session of the Conference of the State Parties to the UNCAC, which shines a new light on the nexus between human rights and grand transnational corruption. But we must go further. Corruption is the antithesis vis-à-vis human rights. Anti-corruption needs to be an even greater component of our work here at the United Nations and beyond, both for contributing to the MDGs and in creating a new and strong responsive framework in the post-2015 development agenda. I look at the vision of this post-2015 development agenda and the proposed sustainable development goals with hope. I would like to welcome the work of the Open Working Group of the General Assembly and in particular the inclusion of proposed Goal 16, achieving peaceful and inclusive societies, rule of law, effective and capable institutions. But I must also confess some concerns. All the aforementioned universal goals, which we all agree on, run the risk of being severely undermined by corruption. It is therefore obvious that the prevention of and fight against corruption needs to constitute a more prominent and explicit component of this ambitious agenda, from social inclusion to economic growth and poverty alleviation. If we are to strengthen the accessibility, availability, and sustainability of human rights, relevant goods and services, and bring poverty to an end, we must openly, steadily, and straightforwardly staunch corruption. And to avoid any misunderstandings or wrongful self-perception, this is true in every nation and in every region. Excellencies, ladies and gentlemen, let us also be frank and forthright. In several countries, including some in the so-called developed world, we continue to see what one might have felt anachronistic, discussions on questioning the separation of powers, on dispensing or neglecting the fundamental principles of the rule of law. Some states still witness debates to bring under the control of one power, normally the government or the parliament, the other power, the other pillar, which is the judiciary, including the prosecution services. Or, instead of reducing or abolishing immunity and impunity regimes for privileged groups of society, including the political sphere, some states still witness deliberations on extending and enlarging such regimes. What is more, such impunities and immunities are apparently too often striking and attractive for power holders to hide behind and thus become de facto extra or super legal. Such developments, however, distinguished delegates, are diametrically opposing fundamental global values. They deeply disrespect the concepts of equality and equity, of justice and fairness, human dignity, and run the risk of reverting any forward trajectory to square one. This brings me to another point. How can we possibly oversee the implementation of the Sustainable Development Goals? Apart from all the international, regional, and other interstate mechanisms and fora, countries may wish to consider developing instruments to review and scrutinize their own implementation. They may do so by strengthening and working with, for example, supreme audit institutions, independent anti-corruption authorities, or other relevant independent national bodies. IACA, as an independent intergovernmental organization which provides neutral ground, stands ready also to contribute as well. We stand ready to empower professionals to provide technical assistance and to guide states, organizations, and corporations in achieving their full potential. Much of what we as a global community will do in the upcoming months and years is contingent to financial resources. In these unsure times of a global financial crisis, which has had severe effects on national budgets and international development aid, we must consider alternative ways of funding. At IACA, for example, which relies on voluntary contribution by its parties, we promote the so-called let crime pay principle as one of these options. It is also a means to an end, anonymously adopted by our own constituency last December in Bangkok, Thailand, and also recognized by the UNCAC in its Article 62. Member states may give special consideration to contributing a percentage of the money or a corresponding value of proceeds of crime or property confiscated to this cause. We are aware of the limitations, but if only a single-digit percentage of these criminal proceeds could eventually be dedicated and facilitated accordingly, programs would be well-funded for decades and poverty eradication soon a worry of the past. Likewise, in providing neutral ground and on a voluntary basis, international organizations like the UN, IACAS or ADA could offer a clearing and facilitating position in guiding penalties and settlements between one body and another resulting from corrupt offenses. In other words, the organizations could be instrumental in consulting how such penalties and settlement money is handled in accordance with international rules and frameworks. Excellencies, ladies and gentlemen, in concluding, complement and augment the rule of law with integrity and credibility, with a fair structure of checks and balances, as well as with a sincere system of separation of powers, strong anti-corruption mechanisms, and credible compliance frameworks, and you will have what we all call and seek for good governance. Good governance, including strong anti-corruption commitment, however, is a most essential anchor and lighthouse of national and international efforts toward poverty eradication and sustainable development, and a fundamental component of the post-2015 development agenda. Thank you very much for your kind attention.
Thank you, Mr. Kreutner, for underlining the global and corrosive nature of corruption on development and for suggesting concrete ways in which to strengthen good governance and integrity of institutions, as well as the role that intergovernmental and international organizations can play in this endeavor. Mr. Deputy Secretary General, thank you for joining us today and for sharing your views. I know you have another very important meeting to go to, but we do appreciate very much the time you have made to spend with us. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
We still have some pending statements from the general debate yesterday. I would now like to revert to the speakers list, after which I will then invite the remaining panelists and the discussants to take the floor. So if I may invite El Salvador, the delegate of El Salvador, to take the floor, please. And it would be much appreciated if the speakers who were on the list yesterday could also take this opportunity to respond to the subject of this panel and contribute to the interactive dialogue. Thank you.
Ahí está. Muchísimas gracias.
Thank you very much. Madam Chairman, I'll do my utmost to interact. However, I do have instructions to make the statement that I have before me that I was going to make yesterday. I would like to ask the President of the General Assembly, through you, to accept our congratulations on this event. It was organized by the office working on the post-2015 agenda. I'd like to talk about the various subjects that are before the General Assembly, which are not necessarily included in the clusters dealt with in the working group on agenda post-2015. We think it's necessary, as we try to define the post-2015 agenda, and as we search for a sustainable development program, to go beyond artificial divisions which have been created in the area of human rights and development. It's also necessary that finally we recognize that the rule of law and strong institutions are essential to implement this agenda. How else could a state exercise ownership of its development if it didn't have capable public institutions that are transparent, that are powerful, making possible interaction between the state and various actors in society? These are the obvious beneficiaries of development policies. The agenda, the 2015 agenda, will have to be built on the pillars that everybody is very familiar with. As we see the development of the working group on the open constitution, it's obvious that in every one of the 16 focal groups, we should try to make an effort to reach agreement on various thematic regimes in the United Nations. Our goal should be that everybody work together and that we work towards sustainable development, which will put human beings in their entire life cycle at the center of action without any discrimination of any kind. We must assume responsibility for human rights as a way of living, not just from a point of view of creating norms. Development, human rights, protection of the environment, fighting against climate change, gender problems, fighting against social violence, all these are obviously part of the same process. This is true of regimes of human rights and the rule of law. We must include the gender problem and incorporation of this, and we will in this way produce real gender equality and the empowerment of women. It's undeniable that this is of special importance as we try to protect and promote human rights for women and girls. The incorporation of references to people who are disabilities in key areas of the agenda will also mean that this group has to be included in policies and the results of sustainable development. It's undeniable that this will also create conditions to promote their rights, as established in the Convention on the Rights of Individuals with Disabilities. It's impossible to deny that indicators in the area of health, education, employment, and others will lead to an improvement in the realization of economic, social, and cultural rights. The post-2015 agenda is the great link between the major pillars of development and human rights. It's also undeniable that in the present draft that we're discussing this month in the working group, we will find elements throughout the text with direct implications for human rights, whether they be civilian, political, economic, social, or cultural rights, the right to development, or the right of specific groups, such as women. Also, it's to be understood that the agenda has to be all-inclusive and universal. At its center, that means it must be free of any discrimination. This is true not only in the question of discrimination regarding class, because of class, sex, ethnic groups, sex, religion, migratory status, or gender identity or sexual orientation. It's important that we, as countries, make an effort strengthening dialogue as we work toward a shared view of migration problems, which are also part of the post-2015 agenda. El Salvador also believes that outmoded versions must be discarded. We must have an important goal before us, that all men, women, all of us, will assume responsibility for our rights as a way of living. And in this way, we can respond to the appeal of the Secretary General to make the post-2015 agenda be guided by human rights. Finally, although it's true that we have to meet major challenges, there are major opportunities for all of us together to build a new paradigm for development. Salvador would invite all agencies in the United Nations to go above and beyond sectoral visions of past years so that we can have an integrated view of our work, both the universal and local level, giving priority at all times to dialogue, solidarity, cooperation, and respect. Also, we would call on everyone to build this development agenda that's inclusive and convergent. All our efforts in various areas, erroneously considered as separate efforts, can come together as we work toward the great goal that we have set for ourselves. I've seen a brief summary of the... I've read the very brief summary of my statement. This will be on the web page. My full statement will be there, and I hope you will all read it. Thank you.
May I thank the delegate of El Salvador and remind speakers to limit their statements to 3 minutes so that everyone has an opportunity to speak. May I now call on the delegate of Costa Rica.
Muchas gracias.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Madam Chairman. I will sum up and adapt the statement that we had prepared so that it will be consistent with the debate that we're holding this morning. But first of all, I'd like to thank the President of the General Assembly for having organized this high-level activity. And also, we'd like to thank the panelists who have participated this morning. And we will thank them, those who will be speaking soon. We also can endorse the statements that were made yesterday by Austria on behalf of the Group of Friends of the Rule of Law and by Chile on behalf of the Human Rights Network. And now, we'd like to make a few general comments. First of all, we believe that as we tackle this subject, it's important to remember the Declaration on the Right to Development of 1986. There, we say, quote, "The human being is the central subject of the development process. Any development policy must consider human beings as a participant and principal beneficiary of development," end of quote. As yesterday it was so often repeated, and as others have said today, democracy, development, human rights, and fundamental freedoms are interdependent concepts. In addition, they're closely related to the achievement of peace, security, and tolerance. These linkages must be strengthened and must be promoted, both because of their intrinsic importance, but because they have an important role to play in the area of creating instruments. Peace, stability, institutional solidity, transparency, the participation of citizens, democratic practices. If all these things can be brought about, people will be masters of their own development, and their development will be placed at the service of their people. We believe there is no reason to argue that if we recognize the central role of human rights and the rule of law in the dynamic of development, we will stimulate external conditionalities. That's not true. We think the opposite is, in fact, true. Well aware of the interdependence of these factors, my delegation has said that human rights dimensions, rule of law, democratic governance, and participation must be a strong presence in the document of the working group who will be working on sustainable development goals. It's also important that this approach be considered in an integrated way in the post-2015 development agenda. Our general frame of reference should be, inter alia, the United Nations Charter, the Universal Declaration on Human Rights, and various covenants and conventions on human rights, and the outcome documents of the World Summit Conference of 2005 and the Declaration on the State of Law of 2012. We think it's important that the universal periodic revision of the Council of Human Rights and machinery, monitoring machinery for human rights must be taken into account. This must be part of the question of accountability, which will be agreed upon. The Declaration on Human Rights is key here. Also, starting with the interaction and indivisibility of human rights, we also believe that rights having to do with health and education are of paramount importance. We would refer also to political participation, independent justice and impartial justice, access to public information, non-discrimination, private ownership, and freedom of expression are all equally important. We also believe that the post-2015 development agenda should also be directly related to human security. In addition, we believe we must continue our work to ensure that the needs and aspirations of the most vulnerable groups in society are duly reflected in the agenda, including the Sustainable Development Goals. As today the panelists have stressed, no society can develop if entire segments of the population are excluded from the public and face social, physical, cultural, or political barriers. Domestically speaking, we believe that the rule of law and respect for human rights find a fertile ground in a democratic political system. The achievement of democracy should be understood beyond just free, periodic, and competitive elections. This also implies freedom of association, freedom of petition and expression, legal security, independence of powers, accountability, and transparency. The state of law, in addition, should be promoted internationally. This means respect not only for multilateral instruments, opening the way to the settlement of disputes. This also means there must be respect for commitments reached mutually among the parties. The developed countries should at least devote 0.7% of their gross domestic product to official development assistance. The complete statement, complete text of our statement, will be made available on the webpage of the General Assembly. Thank you.
I thank the delegate of Costa Rica and give the floor to the delegate of Australia.
Thank you very much, and thank you to the panelists today for their very useful and very informative comments. Australia is committed to ensuring an inclusive, people-centred approach to sustainable development. Human rights and the rule of law must be central to that approach. We heard yesterday and today how central human rights and the rule of law are to addressing poverty, to addressing marginalisation, and to ensure every person has the opportunity to reach their full potential in a post-2015 development framework. And this is appropriate since the UN Charter and its guiding principles remain our touchstone. The very first words of the UN Charter and its preamble set our path. They record that we, the people of the United Nations, are determined to reaffirm our faith in fundamental human rights, in the dignity and worth of the human person, and in the equal rights of men and women and all nations, large and small. The Charter's preamble speaks directly to establishing conditions under which justice and international law are respected, and to promoting social progress and better standards of life in larger freedom. Since then, we have built on this firm foundation, including most recently in the World Summit in 2005, in the High-Level Declaration on the Rule of Law, and in the future we want from Rio+20. The post-2015 framework is our opportunity to rise to that challenge so that we genuinely leave no one behind. as we continue our discussions on the post-2015 development agenda, advancing human rights and the rule of law must be central themes and carefully woven across the goals and target framework. I would like to highlight some specific areas of importance to Australia. First, we attach importance to a standalone goal on stable and peaceful societies, as well as a goal on good governance and effective institutions. These are issues that matter to individual citizens and are about national-level action supported by international cooperation. Targets could include ensuring justice institutions are accessible, independent, well-resourced, and respect due process rights, that they enhance capacity, professionalism, accountability, and legitimacy of the judiciary and the security sector, that they ensure free and universal legal identity, such as birth registrations, that they promote inclusive public participation in democratic politics and civil engagement, that they allow freedom of speech, association, peaceful protest, and access to independent media and information, and as we've heard this morning from the panel, that they also address anti-corruption. At the national level, the rule of law is at the heart of the social contract between the state and its citizens. We have learnt from experience that effective, efficient, and accountable judiciaries, prisons, and police forces are crucial to the promotion of security and development. National ownership and capacity building will be central to that. As we have also learnt, accountability for serious crimes is critical to end impunity and is a critical enabler for development, and we should find a way of reflecting this in the post-2015 development framework. Secondly, all goals must respond to and contribute directly to the rights and empowerment of women and girls. The post-2015 goals and targets must be gender sensitive and require data that is disaggregated by gender. We must ensure women's access to justice and ensure justice systems are responsive to the need of women and girls. More should be done to engage women themselves as actors in justice institutions. Thirdly, we must explore every opportunity in the development agenda to improve the rights of the most vulnerable and marginalised, particularly persons with disability, children and youth, and internally displaced. Laws and policies need to protect the human rights of all and ensure access for all people to equal education, to productive and decent employment and livelihood opportunities. And fourth and lastly, we must build on the progress that we've already made in measuring the achievement of human rights and the rule of law in recent years. Improving data collection and analysis is essential to filling critical gaps, and data needs to be disaggregated across all variables. Mr. President, we have a historic opportunity to build on the ambition and success of the MDGs and the post-20 and Rio Plus 20 outcomes, and work towards a future where societies are resilient and just, and in which everybody will be able to live a dignified life, free from violence, oppression, and exclusion. Collectively, we must rise to this challenge in the post-2015 development framework. I would like to take the opportunity to ask the speakers, therefore, for their thoughts on specific goals and targets which would help inform our thinking on the human rights and rule of law elements to be transformational in the post-2015 agenda. Thank you.
I thank the delegate of Australia and invite the delegate of Serbia to take the floor and remind you to limit your statement to 3 minutes so that we can have time for all speakers. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First of all, I would just like to mention that Serbia has aligned itself to the statement made yesterday by the representative of the EU and makes these remarks from a national perspective very briefly. Human rights and rule of law are profoundly intertwined with sustainable development. The rule of law is a necessary precondition for sustainable peace and development in any society, in line with the principles of UN Charter, particularly as regards respect for national sovereignty, territorial integrity, and non-interference in internal affairs. Fundamental human rights, including the right to life and development, can seriously be undermined by irresponsible human behavior at the global level, affecting nature and causing climate change, such as demonstrated recently by the devastating floods that brought about humanitarian disaster in the Southeast Europe region. This unprecedented natural occurrence, as part of the overall process of climate change, has taken a heavy toll on human life and caused enormous damage to infrastructure throughout Serbia and its neighboring countries. Over 1.6 million people in Serbia have been affected. More than 32,000 have been displaced. There were 33 casualties and 4,000 buildings flooded. It is evident even now that the damage will be measured in hundreds of millions and possibly in excess of €1 billion. Serbia appreciates the readiness of the international community to convene a pledging conference on that behalf. We have learned from this bad experience, unfortunately, that more effort should be put into mitigating the effects of climate change. It poses a serious challenge to human protection, human rights protection, because it provokes natural disasters, and natural disasters cause humanitarian catastrophes. Something has to be done about it globally, as the vulnerable groups, the poor, the elderly, children, and people living in remote areas are the most affected by the consequences. Refugee and IDP issues, similarly, deserves a special mention in the context of the development agenda. Serbia is in the first place in Europe concerning the number of refugees, 58,000 in all, as well as the number of IDPs, 200,000. Less than 5% of the IDPs have returned to their homes in the past 15 years. Only 1.9% of the returns are considered sustainable. The low number of returns is mainly due to a lack of basic human rights and rule of law, discrimination, impossibility to exercise property rights, no access to education and employment, poor economic chances, as noted in UN reports and EU documents, as regards situation in Kosovo particularly. This humanitarian social problem of large proportions call into question the fundamental human rights of IDPs and efforts made so far towards normalization of the situation and reconciliation. We consider that a decisive and comprehensive solution to the IDP problem implies respecting the needs, not just rights, of those expelled. Serbia intends to contribute and promote human rights and the rule of law in the post-2015 development agenda. We are fully committed to achieving high standards in human and minority rights protection and to respecting the major rule of law principles. However, eradicating poverty and high level of unemployment are the most serious challenges that Serbia has to struggle with in the years ahead. In conclusion, let me reiterate that the rule of law cannot exist without protection of human rights and fundamental freedoms as its integral component. By its very nature, it is also one of the basic preconditions for economic, social, and political development of states. I thank you.
I thank the delegate of Serbia and invite the delegate of Rwanda to take the floor.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My delegation aligns itself with the statement delivered by Ethiopia on behalf of the African group. I would also like to commend the President of the General Assembly for organizing this high-level event on this important topic of the contribution of human rights and the rule of law in the post-2015 development agenda. My statement will mainly draw from experience derived from the restoration of the rule of law following the 1994 genocide against the Tutsi. Rwanda recognizes the importance of human rights and the rule of law as one of the key elements of conflict prevention, conflict resolution, and peace building and sustainable development. It is indeed true that protection and promotion of individual rights, justice and security in respect of the rule of law, mitigate conflicts, help reduce the risk of relapse into further conflicts, and create conditions guaranteeing sustainable development and peace. Madam Chair, drawing from our own experience since the 1994 genocide against the Tutsi, we can testify on how the reestablishment of rule of law and the promotion of human rights following the collapse of all institutions contributed in the efforts of reconstruction of the social fabric and later enabled socioeconomic development of all citizens. What helped Rwanda to recover from the deep abyss in which it was plunged by the 1994 genocide was mainly the restoration of the justice system, first through the semi-traditional Gacaca courts that allowed to expeditiously try 1,300,000 genocide suspects, enabled the truth to be revealed, and consequently gave way to easing tensions between the victims and the perpetrators. Therefore, justice and rule of law are interlinked, as no justice could have been served if perpetrators had not been tried and if victims and perpetrators had not embarked the road of reconciliation, while at the same time ensuring that justice was rendered to victims. In addition, in order to effect reconciliation, strong and accountable institutions, including security and governance institutions, had to be put in place in the aftermath of the genocide to ensure the protection of all Rwandans and allow them to trust each other, and also in order to create a peaceful country that could attract strong support of key development partners. Equally important was the implementation of sound political, social, and economic reforms which attracted foreign investment, but also tourism. Third, the promotion of basic human rights to ensure equity for all and to fight against inequalities and discrimination was essential to building a foundation to sustainable development. Once you create an inclusive society where women and other marginalized groups have rights that protect them, you enable their socioeconomic empowerment, affording them to have equal opportunities and to reap the fruits of economic transformation and self-reliance. Targeting marginalized groups, therefore, means that no one should be left behind, especially those living in remote rural areas that are underserved or simply lack basic services, public services. To address that impediment, decentralization is undoubtedly a prerequisite to ensure that all the services are accessible to all citizens. Madam Chair, we also believe that the rule of law has to work hand in hand with other government institutions to ensure that basic rights such as housing, education, health and social services, freedom of movement, etc., are protected and promoted in order to ensure freedom from want and from fear. Besides, ensuring universal health care to combat all chronic diseases, including AIDS, tuberculosis, and malaria, and affording quality education for all provide the basis of any sustainable development. To corroborate that and give way to a development path, Rwanda has put in place some programs referred to as homegrown solutions to tackle poverty eradication, such as providing affordable housing, one cow per family, as well as other various initiatives to upgrade the living conditions of all Rwandans, including the historically marginalized people, indigent genocide survivors, as well as people living with disabilities. These programs resulted in reducing the population under extreme poverty and in curbing poverty, proving that there is a strong correlation between the rule of law and development. On this basis, sound economic governance creates enabling conditions to sustainable development and should be taken as a priority while charting the post-2015 development agenda. No agenda can succeed if it's not human-centered, or if it fails to address the needs of the people. In conclusion, Madam Chair, let me call upon the UN and all UN member states to also support the strengthening of the rule of law, not only at national level, but also at international level, including by ensuring that international justice mechanisms are not politicized and conduct their business in a professional, impartial, and fair manner. This would strengthen their credibility while at the same time ensuring that the rule of law is applied to all equally
as was highlighted in the declaration of the high-level meeting of the General Assembly of 24 September 2012. I thank you.
I thank the representative of Rwanda and now invite the representative of the United States to take the floor.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Let me start by expressing our support for the PGA's initiative to convene a practical discussion of rule of law, human rights, and sustainable development. This is an important opportunity to focus on development and how to empower women and men from around the world with the rights and institutions to enable them to enjoy in shared and sustained prosperity, both for this and future generations. Also, we thank the distinguished panelists for their presentations. It is important that we get this link right in the post-2015 development agenda. As many other speakers have noted, it is very clear that stable, open, and predictable public institutions and environments characterized by the rule of law are an essential underpinning of the kind of long-term, inclusive, sustainable development that our agenda seeks to drive. Effective and accountable institutions are a powerful enabler that are also vital to elevate as a dedicated goal in their own right. Effective governance and a legal environment that assures basic protections and due process is essential for investment and balanced growth, for service delivery, and for guaranteeing the inclusive vision of sustainable development to which we aspire, a life of dignity for all. We see scope for targets in key areas such as free and universal legal identity and birth registration of children. Every year, 50 million children start life without a legal identity because their births are not registered. As a result, these children are often vulnerable to being disappeared or trafficked, condemned to the margins of society, blocked from school and healthcare, and as they mature, unable to open a bank account, own property, vote, or start a business. This is a solvable problem and a clear and compelling target ripe for inclusion in this agenda. Increased participation in decision-making, especially for women and minorities, is vital to the health of all our societies. It helps governments be more responsive and strengthens the mutual responsibilities of state and citizen. Freedom of the media, association, and speech are also equally vital, not least to spur public debate about policy priorities, help monitor the delivery of essential services, such as education and healthcare, and support the innovation and ideas that can offer solutions to some of the most intractable development problems. We also strongly support crafting a target to promote greater transparency and accountability of public institutions. As we have seen in a range of countries, practical innovations like universal publication of government budgets, transparency around natural resource extraction, freedom of information legislation, or the use of peer review mechanisms like the African peer review mechanism have given citizens powerful and effective tools to hold their public servants accountable for better performance, while also giving governments better tools to respond to the needs of their citizens. Let me also emphasize that in our view, women's rights are human rights, and no discussion of human rights is complete without underscoring also the imperative of ending discrimination and violence against women, assuring their equal rights to productive assets like land and credit, and ensuring access to sexual and reproductive health and reproductive rights. Madam Chair, we have heard from dozens of countries powerful testaments to the role that rule of law, good governance, effective institutions, and ensuring human rights for all have played in the development of their economies and the betterment of lives for their citizens. We stand with them in stating that it is absolutely essential for the post-2015 agenda to reflect these critically important issues. Thank you.
I thank the representative of the United States and invite the representative of Saudi Arabia to take the floor.
Shukran, Sayyid Raisa.
Thank you, Madam Moderator. Today, we are meeting to discuss an important subject relating to the rule of law and human rights on one side and its relationship to the post-2015 development agenda on the other hand. In general, we all recognize the importance of all issues related to rule of law and the relationship to many global and national questions, including human rights, peace, security, and justice. Interest in these subjects must start with defining the concept of the rule of law and establishing the parameters and the promotion of international cooperation and supporting countries to implement these standards in accordance with their national legislation. As I have indicated, our meeting today focuses on the rule of law and its relationship to human rights issues, as well as issues of development and their contribution to the post-2015 development agenda. On this basis, at the national level, I wish to stress that the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia is committed to the rule of law in line with the provisions of the Charter of the United Nations, as well as the national legislations in the Kingdom that are anchored in the Islamic faith, including freedom and justice for all, as well as the international global agenda to develop the post-2015 agenda in order to ensure sustainable and better life for future generations. The Kingdom of Saudi Arabia develops its strategies in a way that is based on laws that are ensured in the Islamic faith, Sharia, and to develop them regularly and to develop them according to the changing living conditions and global developments. The alliance of faith and civilization among cultures is very important, and culture is important to the rule of law. And this is the nexus among rule of law, human rights, and future development agenda. Madam Moderator, the ancient and contemporary Islamic law is in line with the rule of law because it is imperative that law should regulate all activities of society, as well as it is in line with the concepts of law that the government must have authority to implement the rule of law. Therefore, Kingdom Saudi Arabia laws ensure the principles of equality, justice, and dignity, and these include human rights for women, children, elderly, and all minorities and ethnicities, maintenance of faith, property, and human sanity are essential norms in the laws of this Saudi Arabia. And in recent times, Saudi Arabia amended many of its national legislations to ensure the development and empowerment of women, youth, and people with disabilities. Madam Moderator, my country recognizes that the need for the world to adopt a new development agenda in order to overcome many challenges, including the eradication party, requires extensive regional and international cooperation in order to establish enablers for implementation. That would be only made possible through a global mechanism that respects the diversity of cultures. And this should be attuned to the development and social needs of all people, irrespective of their age and level of development. We all live on one planet. Our needs are quite similar, but our cultures are different. And this in itself provides an opportunity to cooperate constructively and respect diversity. Here, my country would like to stress the principle of sovereignty and the right of every country to exercise its sovereignty on its own land without external threats. We must stand for the enjoyment of every nation, every people, to enjoy their natural resources and to enjoy economic prosperity in order to ensure peace and stability within those countries. Thank you, ma'am.
I thank the representative of Saudi Arabia and invite the representative of the State of Palestine to take the floor.
Thank you. At the outset, I wish to thank you to the President of the General Assembly for convening this high-level event on the contributions of human rights and the rule of law in the post-2015 development agenda, and to express our appreciation for your active efforts to explore the interrelated aspects relevant to the post-2015 development agenda in a coherent, holistic manner, and your strong commitment to promoting sustainable and attainable development goals for all. Mr. President, the State of Palestine supports the inclusion of the rule of law and respect for human rights as foundational principles in the post-2015 development agenda based on a profound belief that they are among the main keys to ensuring peaceful, stable, economically and socially empowered, resilient, and prosperous societies. In the specific case of Palestine, we firmly believe that they also constitute the keys to ending the occupation and injustice the Palestinian people have been subjected to for decades, comprehensively resolving the conflict, achieving freedom, human rights, and justice for our people, and establishing peace and security. Thus, on 1 April 2014, the State of Palestine made the noble decision to accede to several international conventions, among them the core human rights treaties, including inter alia, the International Covenants on Civil and Political Rights and on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights, the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women, the Convention on the Rights of the Child, and the Optional Protocol to the Convention on the Rights of the Child on the Involvement of Children in Armed Conflict, the Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities, the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Racial Discrimination, and the Convention Against Torture and Other Cruel, Inhumane, or Degrading Treatment or Punishment, as well as the core humanitarian law conventions, the four Geneva Conventions and Additional Protocol 1, and the Hague Convention on War on Land and its annexed regulations. The State of Palestine is honored, proud, and humbled by the opportunity to be a state party to these important international instruments alongside other states' parties. We wish today to reaffirm our strong commitment to upholding our responsibilities under the conventions to which we have become a state party, and to promoting full respect of the human rights and principles enshrined therein. Palestine fully recognizes the critical importance of developing and maintaining a strong societal backbone rooted in the rule of law and human rights for shaping and sustaining development nationally, regionally, and internationally. The challenge for the State of Palestine, however, has been that we remain in the midst of conflict, a now 47-year military occupation, whereby Israel, the occupying power, continues to commit systematic and gross human rights violations against the Palestinian people and to aggressively colonize the Palestinian land in grave breach of international humanitarian law. The cumulative impact of these illegal practices has inflicted great hardship and humanitarian suffering on our people and has severely undermined our aspirations and efforts to develop our society and nation at all levels and in all fields. Indeed, the special event on the Millennium Development Goals outcome document clearly recognized the special challenges to meeting the MDGs faced by people living under foreign occupation. In this regard, relevant reports point to the direct negative impact of Israeli violations on the prospects for sustainable development in Palestine. Thus, in our pursuit of the post-2015 development goals, a central priority will remain bringing an end to the Israeli occupation that began in 1967, achieving the independence and sovereignty of the State of Palestine with East Jerusalem as its capital, and justly addressing all core issues in order to end this prolonged conflict and establish peace, security, and coexistence between the State of Palestine and Israel. We believe these to be imperative for ensuring the ultimate success of our efforts to promote sustainable development, eradicate poverty and hunger, and promote the enjoyment of human rights and fundamental freedoms, democracy, and prosperity for our people. We thus join the many other states that emphasize the necessity of ensuring that human rights and the law underpin our future sustainable development goals, and we reaffirm our readiness to uphold our national as well as international duties and obligations in this regard, including in the context of collective efforts to promote sustainable development for all in the post-2015 era, recognizing that, quote, lasting peace and sustainable development cannot be fully realized without respect for human rights and the rule of law, end quote. As was so rightly stated in the Secretary General's report, A Life of Dignity for All. I thank you.
The representative of Palestine, and I would also like to thank the representative of the International IDEA for agreeing to speak that afternoon. That brings us to the end of the list of speakers from yesterday's general debate for this morning. I would now like to invite our last panelist, Nicholas Luciani, the director of the Human Rights Policy Program at the Center for Economic and Social Rights, to make his presentation.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Excellencies, esteemed panelists, delegates, ladies and gentlemen. I first want to send a special thanks to the Office of the President of the General Assembly for organizing this critical and very timely session for reflection and more importantly, for action. It's an honor to contribute. My organization, the Center for Economic and Social Rights, has worked at, indeed, the artificial borderlands between human rights and human development for over two decades. And as co-convener of the broad-based post-2015 Human Rights Caucus, a coalition from all regions across constituencies, we come to you today with one clear message. Human rights, including the right to development, can and must have real operational significance this time around in guiding sustainable development policy and practice. Based on our experience and yesterday and today's sessions, I think there's an overwhelming support for human rights and the right to development to found the sustainable development goals, targets, and indicators. The question on our mind is not what value human rights and the rule of law provides to sustainable development, but indeed, how can we embed the human rights norms, standards, and principles into the existing framework of goals, targets, and indicators, as well as in means of implementation, in particular, to build an effective financing strategy and a functional and credible monitoring and accountability framework. So first, I want to get to the point on human rights as a guide on how the sustainable development goals, targets, and indicators can be set. As the post-2015 Human Rights Caucus, I'm very proud to announce the release today of a new litmus test tool. This tool provides a set of eight basic questions and more detailed assessment criteria, enabling all those involved in the design of the Sustainable Development Goals to more objectively assess whether the goals, targets, and indicators do indeed respect and reflect pre-existing human rights legal standards, including obligations of both a domestic and an international or global nature. Indeed, it's time to make choices, and the question is how to prioritize. We think this tool can help member states and others to make the right decisions on the future of the sustainable development framework. Let me give you a bit of a brief analysis of this litmus test and description of it. The test aims to assess whether the post-2015 proposals support the universality and mutual interdependence of economic and social and cultural, as well as civil and political rights, as was brought out by many speakers today, in particular insisting on the freedoms of expression, association, peaceful protest, political participation, access to information, and guarantees for an enabling society, an enabling environment for civil society, human rights, and environmental defenders, who are indeed at the front lines of ensuring sustainable development. Second, the test inquires whether proposals stimulate full transparency and meaningful participation of all people without fear in the design, in the implementation, and in the monitoring of all relevant policies and programs, not only locally and nationally, but also those that are made at the international or regional level. Third, we need to assess whether goals, targets, and indicators are designed to ensure the human rights accountability of all development actors, including the private sector. This would involve provisions on the right to an effective remedy at the national level through responsive and impartial justice systems, but also it would involve provisions on protecting the right to effective remedy internationally when state policies and practices have adverse spillover effects across borders, in particular in trade, tax, financial regulation, and monetary policies. The question here is, how do we subject the rule of international human rights law, how do we subject these economic policies at the international level to the rule of international human rights law? The litmus test further asks whether proposals effectively combat substantive inequality and end discrimination in all its forms, prioritizing a more ambitious rate of progress for those most disadvantaged, and including specific commitments to combat economic inequality within and between countries. The human rights of women and girls is also a key criterion, entailing, amongst other things, access to sexual and reproductive health services, the prevention of gender-based violence, women's control over productive and natural resources, and reductions in women and girls' burdens of unpaid work. The litmus test also provides a tool to evaluate whether current proposals secure a minimum floor of social well-being, as is a duty on states, in particular by guaranteeing a quality social protection floor for all. Lastly, and as a global development framework, perhaps most important, the key question that this litmus test on human rights post-2015 poses is whether any global partnerships for development are aligned with existing human rights duties of an international nature. I don't have time to get into detail, and hopefully we can in the interactive session, but this would require, amongst other things, that human rights-guided policy coherence is ensured, with governments and large businesses mandated to conduct independent and periodic public assessments of the human rights and sustainable development impacts of their policies and agreements outside of their country. Logically, this would involve clear time-bound commitments for all actors in development, unlike MDG 8, which created a skewed system of accountability and did not include clear time-bound commitments for wealthier countries. And this provides a great segue to the next question of means of implementation. We know that a perfect set of post-2015 commitments are just ink on parchment without effective means of implementation. In particular, in developing a finance strategy which is robust and fair, and developing an accountability and monitoring framework which is credible and just. Human rights can usefully support both. First, human rights offers a critical tool for improving how these new goals can be paid for. It is hard to see how an ambitious and transformative set of renewed goals will be realized without putting in place a financing strategy to ensure, first, the sufficiency, second, the equality, and third, the accountability of resources for sustainable development. Human rights can boost each of these three fundamental conditions for an effective, sustainable financing strategy, as is detailed in length in our recent publication with ChristianAid, A Post-2015 Fiscal Revolution. And I hope we can get into those issues also in the interactive session. The third and final point is really the linchpin of them all. Human rights and, in fact, the rule of international human rights law can greatly improve the means by which all development actors are held to account for their sustainable development performance. As evidenced in our publication with the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights last year, who will be accountable, success or failure in the design of effective accountability mechanisms for the post-2015 development framework will really mark the difference between real transformation and yet another set of unfulfilled promises. So rather than one single new silver bullet accountability mechanism, we at CESR are proposing a more systems approach, what we could call a web of sustainable development accountability, which would ensure that failures in one place are communicated throughout this web. This would involve especially in bringing existing human rights protection systems at the national, regional, international levels to bear in sustainable development accountability. At present, sadly, the development accountability framework still suffers from tremendous fissures and silos between mechanisms, each with their own specific functions and communities, but unable to yet meaningfully engage with others. We need more constructive interaction between different mechanisms at different levels, accounting for the conduct of different actors, states, international institutions, and the private sector, providing different functions, monitoring, review, providing remedies, as well as potentially focusing on different sectoral goals, such as water and sanitation, and health, given good practices that are already under existence. One place to start would be at the international level, where the accountability gaps are arguably the greatest. Benefiting from their respective and in many ways complementary mandates, constructive interaction between the international human rights protection regime, the Universal Periodic Review, Special Rapporteurs, treaty bodies, and the Sustainable Development Accountability Mechanisms, in particular the High-Level Political Forum, could drive really improved accountability. Treaty bodies, for example, are already monitoring and producing recommendations on the cross-border impacts of particular government policies, in particular on trade, investment, and corporate governance policies. This is an incredibly rich source of jurisprudence and recommendations that the High-Level Political Forum could benefit from, and it could leverage its own mandate to strengthen the political will to live up to these recommendations. Excellencies, ladies and gentlemen, to conclude, framing the new sustainable development commitments in line with existing human rights obligations, re-envisioning how these commitments are financed sufficiently, equitably, and accountably, and bringing mechanisms of human rights enforcement to bear and boosting performance are surely amongst the most powerful ways to incentivize sustainable development for all. Thank you.
Thank you, Nicholas. And we now have two discussants for this panel. And after that, the floor will be opened for comments, observations, and questions. Let me invite the first discussant, Mr. Thomas Hughes, the Executive Director of Article 19. And if I could encourage you to limit your comments to not more than 5 minutes. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, Excellencies, ladies and gentlemen. In my role as a discussant, I will try and pick out and highlight some of the themes that have been made from the panel in their presentations. And I would mention from the outset that being broadly in agreement with almost everything that's been said, I think I find myself maybe with the easiest job in the room today. I will try and do this in accordance with the agenda based around two broad sort of themes. The first is to look at how human rights and the rule of law have been applied in development to date. And the second, the lessons learned that can assist the post-2015 development agenda. Let me also please first also mention that Article 19 is here today as a member of Beyond 2015, which many of you will be familiar with already, but let me just mention briefly that this represents over 1,000 civil society organizations from 132 countries, the majority of which are from the Global South. And we're also members of the post-2015 Human Rights Caucus, which Mr. Luciani mentioned, and the Global Forum for Media Development, which again has about 300 organizations in it. So on the question of human rights and the rule of law in development to date, reflecting the comments made by Minister Migiro, as well as Mr. Luciani just briefly there, in the pre-2015 development context, economic growth was often held as the main benchmark of development. But this alone cannot work for sustainable development if it is to deliver freedom from fear and want. As is widely acknowledged, the MDGs were created through a top-down process and failed to take adequately into account human rights and the rule of law. These shortcomings have been repeatedly linked to some of the failings that have been discussed here today around the MDGs. As Commissioner Strasser mentioned, there is an increasing global recognition over the past years of a human rights-based approach to development founded on the principles of participation, accountability, non-discrimination, empowerment, and the rule of law. Moreover, such a rights-based approach is also consistent with member states' existing duty to undertake positive measures to ensure access to justice, participation in public affairs, personal security, freedom of expression, access to information, and association and assembly. Evidence across a number of development sectors, whether they be from health to education or water to food, show that a rights-based approach promoting access to information, independent media, and participatory decision-making are essential for securing better social and economic development outcomes for all, including the most marginalized and vulnerable populations. And here I would reference a very new study published by the World Bank and the Dominican Republic that found that access to information improved both community participation and trust in government. Article 19 thus believes that there is substantial evidence to support the need for a governance and rule of law goal, and that this has been widely recognized in various reports and resolutions of the General Assembly, the Open Working Group, the High-Level Panel, the Secretary General and others. And as highlighted by the delegate from Costa Rica, I think there's a specific relevance that should be, or reference that should be made to the right to development as underpinning human rights and the rule of law. I would also like to highlight that in May 2014, an unprecedented 31 UN special rapporteurs and experts, including those on extreme poverty, water, health, environment, indigenous persons, and housing, issued detailed recommendations on how media freedom, access to information, freedom of expression, and freedom of assembly and association are fundamental for the achievement of development goals and should be recognized in the post-2015 framework. The post-2015 framework must also recognize the important role of civil society plays in promoting sustainable development as established in international policy for nearly 30 years, from the Brundtland Commission report to the 1992 Rio Declaration, the Millennium Declaration, Agenda 21, and most recently, Rio Plus 20, the World We Want Declaration. Additionally, the use of ICTs to promote and underpin sustainable development must be included in the goals, both in terms of access to the internet and human rights online. So under the second question, how can the lessons learned assist the post-2015 development agenda? If sustainable development in the post-2015 era is to deliver freedom from fear and want, then it must reflect the full range of international standards for political, civil, economic, cultural, and social rights. This is, as Commissioner Strasser stressed, human rights, as well as the Deputy Secretary General, of course, human rights are universal, and it's therefore essential that they are recognized if sustainable development is to be achieved. To accomplish this, Article 19 would like to see a freestanding goal on governance and the rule of law that covers all aspects of the development agenda to ensure accountability. It should be based on international human rights law and the commitments made in the 2000 Millennium Declaration and the recommendations of the high-level panel. We believe this goal should include targets on access to information, freedom of expression, freedom of association, freedom of assembly, and the protection of human rights defenders and media from attacks and unlawful limits on their activities. As Dean Kreutner stated, Article 19 is also pleased to see the freestanding Goal 16 to achieve peaceful and inclusive societies, rule of law, effective and capable institutions in the zero draft of the Open Working Group. We also have concerns and have made recommendations for improving the language, which are available on a website that we've created called empoweringdevelopment.org. And although I will definitely go over my 5 minutes, if there's an opportunity to answer the delegate from Australia maybe later in the discussion around specific wording, that would be great, because we also have some very specific text that we think should be included. I will conclude now. So in conclusion, I'd like to actually reference back to the panel and pick out three quotes. So poverty is about the denial of human rights, as the chair mentioned. And realizing human rights and the rule of law in sustainable development is a matter of simple justice, as Minister Migura mentioned. And lastly, as the Deputy Secretary General stated, people are the best drivers of their own development. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hughes. I now invite the last discussant of this panel to take the floor, and that's Ms. Pooja Parvathy of Vada Natoro Abhiyan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Distinguished panelists, ladies and gentlemen, the issue of human rights and rule of law remains fundamental for the new development agenda to be successful. And just like the discussant did mention, that we also find ourselves in agreement with most of what has been shared by the other panelists and many of the member states as well. In particular, I would like to welcome USA's remarks in terms of what was shared. So just to give you maybe a couple of examples, be it the case of Irom Sharmila, a woman in India's Manipur state, who's been on a hunger protest for the last 13 years, demanding repeal of a law that gives armed forces the power to shoot and kill with absolutely no one to answer to, or the alarmingly increasing brutal rape crimes across India, be it the gang rape of a young woman, Nirbhaya, who succumbed to her injuries last year, or the more recent incident in Uttar Pradesh where two teenage girls were raped and hanged from a tree, or the Boko Haram crimes in Nigeria that uses terror to hold people to ransom. All of these are but manifestations of inability of the state to ensure fundamental human rights to all its citizens, particularly women and the most marginalized communities, and the failure to provide effective legal redress. These are also in no unclear terms guided by the macroeconomic framework that influences policy perspectives and the attendant policy actions. A case in point being the impact of neoliberal policies on women, where these policies may provide new economic opportunities, but they also perpetuate patriarchal controls, restrict women's economic, social, and reproductive rights, and lead to crimes and violence against women. We have heard a lot of recommendations and suggestions, I would like to maybe just pick out seven and be extremely brief on these. And these recommendations are outcome of consultations that have been conducted by the Abhiyan, which is a coalition of around 4,000 civil society organizations and networks in the country, with disadvantaged communities such as Muslims, women, persons with disabilities, Dalits, Adivasis, youth, and children. We do feel that it is important that the post-2015 SDG agenda address root causes of violence and conflict and build on existing commitments to promote sustainable development and peace. It is also imperative to stress justice-based governance, which has also been emphasized already, as a tool to enable better institutionalization of rule of law and other practices to foster peaceful societies. The first point would be ensure security of all people of all ages, particularly women, minorities, indigenous people, those affected by caste discrimination and untouchability, through recognition and acceptance of different identities, freedom to practice diverse religions, and recognition of gender crimes. Implementation of channels are available, which are, I wouldn't get into that at the moment. Two, access to justice for all, which would include ensuring availability of free, quality legal resources for the most marginalized, reducing time taken in justice delivery, independence in judicial appointments, and also critical, and our independent, accountable police based on protection of rule of law and citizenship rights, and putting in place appropriate checks and mechanisms in countries where police systems have plenipotentiary powers. Above all, greater emphasis in training police in human rights. Three, rights-based, non-discriminatory, universal access to basic public goods and services for decent human existence, and this would be without conditionalities. It is also vital and to ensure the regulatory and accountability mechanisms are applicable for the partnerships that we are talking about as a whole, and more specifically of private sectors who are involved in public service delivery. Four, transparent and accountable governance processes, practices, and mechanisms to promote free and equal participation of all stakeholders, to review decisions taken at national, local, regional, and global levels. There are, again, specific transparency and accountability mechanisms, which more or less are synonymous to what have been shared, so I would not get into that. Five, inclusive and responsive processes, mechanisms, and institutional apparatus to implement equitable governance practices that address concerns of the most marginalized communities. A specific case in point being gender-responsive budgeting. Further, addressing systemic weaknesses and capacity constraints in terms of staffing, infrastructure, and implementation will be necessary. Something just to share with you that a constant refrain that we hear is about lack of resources. Taking just India's case, even if half of the tax revenue that is foregone by the central government owing to a plethora of tax exemptions given to the businesses and other sectors is withdrawn, it would generate additional tax revenue worth 3% of GDP, which could significantly address infrastructural and staffing gaps in critical sectors like health and education. Six, promotion of integrity in public life and eliminate corruption. Three specific ways, checking tax evasion, illicit financial flows, plugging in illicit financial flows, and increase transparency in global financial systems through process reforms. Seventh, finally, it is imperative that the post-2015 SDG agenda integrate a rights-based and justice framework within all governance processes and mechanisms in order to ensure public participation in all democratic processes as indicated in the Millennium Declaration and in the UDHR Articles 6, 8, 19, and 21. It is only then that the voices of women like Sharmila and the brutalities inflicted on the numerous Nirbhayas the world over will be truly heard. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I thank Pooja. And now I open the floor for comments and questions. and I would encourage you to limit your intervention to 3 minutes so that all requests for the floor can be accommodated. Delegations are, of course, encouraged to provide their full-length statements to the Secretariat for posting in the PaperSmart portal. And unless you may already be aware, but in case you are not, may I also remind you that the debate is live and that Twitter messages may be communicated to #PGAPost2015. I call on the representative of Benin to take the floor.
Je vous remercie.
I thank you, Madam Chair, and I would like to thank the panelists for the very informative presentations that they made to us, and also for the, let us say, the positive ideas that the discussants brought to today's panel. I would especially like to welcome Madame Mijiro. I'm very happy to see her here at the United Nations, and I would also like to say that the rule of law is considered as an essential condition in achieving the Sustainable Development Goals. Benin, which I represent, is considered on the path to democracy, and I would like to give you certain experience of certain items in its recent experience. It is key to have freedom of speech as an expression of liberty, and we must also ensure this so that it serves the common good in defending and promoting the fundamental values of national consensus. And here we have reached a level where we have felt the need to adopt a national charter of values of democracy and governance to which all members of society adhere. The exercise of power in the respect of equality and the constant search for equality are key for national cohesion in a multi-ethnic state such as Benin. Equal access to national resources and the participation of all to the management of state affairs are key. Governments must ensure national balance in all areas regarding public affairs management and in all decision-making in public affairs. Constitutions are also key. It must be based on the history of the country, and it must integrate and become a framework for peaceful relations in the society. This is key if we want to ensure sustainable development. We must not economize in our reform process. We must ensure a rigorous civil society that will allow the citizens to have the resources to plan their own future. The rule of law also is based on democratic institutions that work well within their own mandates, including their capacities, their functions, and they must be part of active cooperation with the international community. And here, I would like to welcome the impact of the cooperation mechanisms and within national institutions, which have been implemented and has improved their operations at the national level. Among the institutions, there's one that requires specific attention, and that is the judiciary as a whole. We must ensure to have sustainable development, there must be an impartial judiciary dedicated to the administration of justice. Impunity kills the republic, and we must be sure that justice is strong enough to deal with it. The government has the responsibility to make sure that rights must not be prejudiced against. The tribunals and courts must be built, and we must ensure that they have qualified personnel working there, and this will lead to justice and the justice system participating in social balance within the society. Here I'd also like to underline the importance that prisons become more humane and serve to rehabilitate criminals and allow them to learn better behavior in order to retake their place in society as a full-fledged citizen. We must ensure that our prisons become schools and training centers. And this requires significant investment. That is one of the important aspects of sustainable development. Combating corruption is also of crucial importance, and this is important to manage transparency and financial management. And we must ensure that corruption is eliminated through the framework of the functioning of the state itself. And this is what we would like to bring as our contributions to the debate on this very important topic of the importance of the rule of law in the post-2015 development agenda. I thank you.
I thank the representative of Benin and invite the representative of the European Union to take the floor.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, and I also thank the panelists and the discussants for their most interesting presentations today. It was really a pleasure to listen to this discussion. As we have heard today, respect for and protection and fulfillment of human rights, as well as the rule of law, is a prerequisite for achieving poverty eradication and sustainable development. The application of these principles is central to ensuring the empowerment of the poorest and most vulnerable, in particular women and girls, which in turn contributes to poverty eradication efforts. As we have heard today, human rights and the rule of law are making essential contributions and are true enablers of poverty eradication and sustainable development. We concur with the speakers on the panel that have elaborated on these obvious linkages. When we look at the contributions of human rights and rule of law for development as we do today, we need to look at preliminary evaluations of the MDGs that have shown that we need to focus on good governance and rule of law at all levels as enablers for sustainable development, as well as important goals in their own right. The rule of law provides a stable and transparent environment that is essential for economic development and investment, fighting corruption and discrimination. I want to emphasize that national ownership in rule of law activities is very important in this regard. People should also be empowered to claim their rights. Freedom of expression, freedom of assembly and association, social dialogue, and meaningful political participation have proved essential in this regard. Let me also underline that, as Mr. Hughes mentioned, civil society plays a fundamental role in promoting human rights and rule of law, and thereby is also enabling sustainable development, notably through their contribution to the empowerment of rights holders, awareness raising, and fostering accountability and transparency. In closing, as the panel drew on experiences of the MDGs and from national experiences today, it is clear that human rights needs to be mainstreamed across the post-2015 development agenda, and that rule of law is being firmly anchored to make any achievements of the new development framework truly sustainable. Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much for your statement and for sticking to the time limit. May I now invite the representative of Israel to take the floor.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would like to start by thanking the distinguished speakers for their interesting presentations. I will also say that yesterday, in our national statement, we referred to the central relevance of human rights and rule of law for poverty eradication as well as sustainable development, and the need to put a special focus on gender equality in the new agenda. Allow me now to refer to some remarks that were made earlier today regarding Israel. I find it quite ironic that the Palestinian delegate once again neglected to mention the many human rights abuses by the Palestinian Authority security apparatus operating in the West Bank. It is also strange to hear her discuss the situation and not hear Hamas mentioned even once. Hamas, an internationally recognized terrorist organization, uphold draconian laws that marginalize their civilians, especially women. Divorced women in Gaza who remarry lose custody of the children. Women in Gaza are not allowed to sing in public. They are not allowed to walk in the street without a male relative. They can't even ride a bicycle. The so-called morality police arrest those infringing the rules. Women face beating for dressing immodestly. On youth, Hamas' record is just as appalling. Just a few weeks ago, the Ministry of Education of the Hamas government froze the teaching of human rights in UNRWA schools, claiming that the human rights curricula contain serious irregulations affecting the Palestinian cause and cultures. And it is with this terror organization that the Palestinian Authority chose to form a government rather than to continue to engage with Israel toward a real solution for sustainable peace in the region. I would just like to say that it is disappointing that the Palestinians choose to once again completely ignore the facts and take the easy path of blaming Israel rather than dealing with their own responsibilities on this matter. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. I now call on the representative of the Russian Federation.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would also like to thank the members of this discussion and the panelists for their interesting and engrossing presentations today. Several times the topic was raised that ensuring human rights and the rule of law is an essential element to eliminate poverty and for sustainable development. I, with every respect to those who spoke these words, am not in agreement. In fact, it is the opposite. Sustainable development and poverty eradication are essential elements to ensure all categories of human rights. During the 2005 Global Summit, the international community ensured the link between the three pillars of the UN's activities and those of international relations, which are sustainable development, peace, security, and ensuring human rights. But now, we are constantly facing this unilateral interpretation of this. And here, during this discussion, defining the sustainable development goals should carefully reflect the thesis that ensuring human rights is impossible without sustainable development. And the same is regarding the rule of law. Sustainable rule of law is impossible without sustainable development. Secondly, I would like to note that the main responsibility to ensure human rights, whether we want it or not, is on states themselves and the international community plays only a complementary role in these processes. And it is concerning to hear a statement that sustainable development and facilitating sustainable development must be part of human rights or the rule of law. This is a concept that has yet to be defined clearly. Does not have an internationally agreed element. And we must be sure that in developing any indicators on the rule of law or to include these indicators in the list of goals or indicators for sustainable development is, I would say, a bit early, because sustainable development is more social and economic development and not legal development. The third thing I wanted to note, in the United Nations organization, there are many avenues of activity, and we must clearly follow the separation of work so that the forum that is dealing with human rights and the rule of law would not evaluate the situation with sustainable development and vice versa. Evaluating human rights is possible, but this has to do with, this is dealt with at the legal, at the universal level by human rights organizations. And the same is true at the regional level. Nevertheless, not all human rights can be valued and evaluated. I would like to ask the panelists the following. How can they see the opportunity to evaluate the level of the right to development in every country? And the last, Madam Chair, I would like that in the UN discussion, and not only in discussions on the SDGs, they would take into account human rights and not their interpretation or definition. I thank you.
I thank the representative of the Russian Federation, and now I invite the Deputy Minister of Foreign Affairs of Slovenia to take the floor.
Chair, ladies and gentlemen, I would like to present our experience and our positions regarding human rights, rule of law, and development. First, human rights and rule of law were the driving forces for the establishment of the Slovenia as independent state in 1992. That was 22 years ago. Only 12 years after the Slovenian independence in 2004, Slovenia became a donor state by joining the EU. The key message of the strategic documents regarding international development cooperation of Slovenia, like the International Development Cooperation Act and Resolution on International Development Cooperation adopted by Slovenian Parliament for the period until 2015, it's very clear, and it is that poverty must be fought through the promotion of human rights and sustainable and inclusive economic growth. So, international human rights and are at the core of Slovenia's poverty reduction efforts and are the main pillar upon which Slovenia based its development cooperation. In doing so, we will pursue a human rights-based approach to development. If we look at the Millennium Declaration adopted September 2000, we can read that, I quote, "We will spare no effort to promote democracy and strengthen the rule of law, as well as respect for all international recognized human rights and fundamental freedoms," end of quoting. This sounds like a symphony, but unfortunately unfinished symphony. What if we look what's happening in the world today, we can see that people across the world have come into the streets to protest against the government, asking them to ensure freedom from fear and freedom from want. They protest against the development model that's not functioning perfectly. So I think that it's time that we finish the unfinished symphony. Thank you for your attention.
Thank the representative of Slovenia, and in keeping with the interactive multi-stakeholder nature of this event, I would now like to invite the Secretary General of the Community of Democracies to take the floor.
Microphone to the speaker.
Is it not on? Yes, thank you.
Thank you for the opportunity to address this important panel devoted to the contributions of human rights and the rule of law towards sustainable development. I also wish to thank the panelists and discussants for their excellent contributions. Let me start by quoting the Millennium Declaration, the founding document of the Development Goals. Men and women have the right to live their lives and raise their children in dignity, free from hunger and from the fear of violence, oppression, or injustice. Democratic and participatory governance based on the will of the people best assures these rights, end of quote. In the same year that the Millennium Declaration was adopted, the year 2000, the world's democracies gathered in Warsaw in Poland and pledged to protect and promote all human rights. These more than 100 nations committed themselves to working together to strengthen the democratic institutions that would ensure that these rights are protected. Recognition of the universality of human rights is clear in the Warsaw Doctrine of the Community of Democracies. The nations gathered represented all corners of the earth, poor and rich, new democracies and well-established ones, and north and south and east and west. Among the promises they made was also to assist each other in economic and social development, including the eradication of poverty. Our current chair, El Salvador, is especially committed to these principles and has made democracy and development one of the top priorities of its presidency. And at the last ministerial meeting in Ulaanbaatar, the participants vowed to work together to emphasize human rights, fundamental freedoms, and democratic governance as integral parts of inclusive development and the eradication of extreme poverty as the international community works to formulate the post-2015 development framework. Human rights are based on the conviction that all persons are created equal. This translates into the combat against poverty and social exclusion, as well as the political principle of one person, one vote. In numerous declarations, reports, and statements, the international community has time and again emphasized the strong linkage between economic and social development and the principles of political and civil rights. The two sets of human rights, as set out in the covenants adopted in 1966, are universal, inseparable, mutually reinforcing, and impossible to fully realize without implementing the other. Democracy is needed to liberate the forces that demand social and economic change. And democratically elected governments have a duty to ensure economic and social development and respond to citizens' needs. Human dignity is not divisible between social and or political dignity. They go together. The citizens' collective outcry for dignity during the Arab Spring taught us that. If your plot of land has been confiscated, how can you fight to get it back if there is no rule of law? If your leaders are corrupt and spend the government's money on making their families rich, how can you stop that if there is no freedom of expression? If you cannot freely elect your leaders in elections with integrity, how could there ever be accountability? This is reflected clearly in the Millennium Declaration. Throughout the document, in almost every paragraph and almost every sentence of the declaration adopted by the United Nations General Assembly, the interconnection between democracy, rule of law, and respect for human rights on one hand, and the combat of poverty on the other, is emphasized. Unfortunately, this was not reflected in the first generation of Millennium Development Goals. Now we have an opportunity to improve the goals and put them not only up to date with today's development challenges, adding the aspect of sustainability, but also ensure that they mirror the ambitions of their founding document. This need for a rights-based approach to the development goals has also been expressed by the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Ms. Navi Pillay, both in an open letter to the UN member states in June last year and also yesterday in her video message. In arguing the case for a human rights-based approach for the post-2015 agenda, she refers to the RioPlus20, the UN System Task Team, the Global Thematic Consultations processes, and others processes that came to the same conclusion. Human rights in their totality must be at the bottom of the global development agenda. During the discussion yesterday, many speakers, not the least those representing large groups of UN member states and many of them active participants and members of the community of democracies, reaffirmed over and over again the necessity for a human rights approach to the next generation of development goals. Let me end by offering a reflection, reinforcing the message from El Salvador earlier today about a paradigm shift. Development is traditionally referred to as social and economic development, or the implementation of economic, social, and cultural rights, if you so will. Perhaps it is now time to consider the development of an integrated concept of development, including also civil and political human rights. Rule of law, respect for political and civic rights, and democratic institutions, all clearly framed as norms of the United Nations in the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, are not only central as instruments for achieving social and economic development, but their implementation is the essence of development. The ICCPR enjoys an equal status with the International Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights, not only as a supporting agent, which these rights are as well, but as goals in their own right for the development that the United Nations seek to achieve globally. It is time to say achieving respect for all human rights is what constitutes development, and this needs to be reflected in the future sustainable development goals. The community of democracies look forward to working with the UN and our member states to strengthen the effort to focus global development on both freedom from want and freedom from fear. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your statement. I now invite the representative of the International Chamber of Commerce to take the floor.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I am the permanent representative to the United Nations for the International Chamber of Commerce, and I'm also the organizing partner for the Business and Industry Major Group and the coordinator of the Global Business Alliance for Post-2015. The International Chamber of Commerce has enjoyed consultative status at the United Nations since 1946, bringing the balanced voice of business to the numerous intergovernmental deliberations over this long history. I greatly appreciate the President of the General Assembly for organizing this critically important event in the series of high-level events in the lead-up to post-2015. I can assure you that for the business community, respect for human rights, rule of law, governance, capable institutions are the critical and overarching preconditions for sustainable development. At all levels, domestic markets, foreign investment, and international trade, private enterprise requires an operating environment conducive to growth and development, including peace and stability, rule of law, good governance with accountability and transparency, the absence of corruption, adequate infrastructure, an educated workforce, clear property rights, and enforceable contracts. States must ensure that markets and entrepreneurial activity are not stifled by unfair competition, corruption, or an unstable policy environment. They must establish rules that clarify property rights, reduce the cost of resolving disputes, increase the predictability of economic interactions, and provide contractual partners and investors with certainty and protection against abuse. The basic responsibilities of businesses are set out in the legal frameworks of the states within which they have activities and include compliance with laws relating to labor rights and environmental protection at a minimum. Commercial law, depending on how one drafts it, can promote local productive capacity or make one's local markets less competitive. It may create mechanisms to ensure accountability or may only give impression that it does so. It can create market incentives for corporate responsibility and good governance, or can promote fraudulent activities. It may be an effective deterrent of conflicts triggered by economic factors by addressing their root causes, or may trigger conflicts by creating an environment where favoritism and corruption flourishes and inequalities are involved. Outdated commercial law framework is a major impediment to development. It creates barriers to the formalization of the informal sector of the economy. In the end, it does not allow states to achieve effective mobilization of resources for sustainable development. A government structure is dependent on the consistent and systematic application of legal rules. The lack of universal protection for private property and contractual rights constitutes a substantive constraint on economic freedom by inhibiting or disincentivizing investment and trade. As such, the rule of law and the protection of private property and contractual rights constitute an important prerequisite for private investment-driven economic growth and high productivity. A functional legal system is not only key in building economic foundations, it is also crucial in safeguarding democratic values. Without an integrated system of institutions that create order and facilitate daily transactions of all types, from traffic law to business contracts, true rule of law and true democratic governance are lacking. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your statement. I would now like to turn to the panelists who have been listening to the speakers and see whether anyone would like to respond to the comments. There was also a question raised about the evaluation of the right to development. And so may I look at the panelists and see who would like to respond to what you've heard so far. Nicholas?
Thank you very much. I hope the other panelists also can step in. Well, first of all, I really want to commend Costa Rica in rebutting an argument that human rights is a tool of aid conditionality in some kind. It's very important that everyone recognizes that as civil society, we're not suggesting that human rights should be some type of conditionality in sustainable development. The key question is, how do you get the balance right between the national level human rights obligations and the human rights obligations of an international nature? And in this, I just want to refer to something that could be of use to the sustainable development conversation, and that is a document called the Maastricht Principles on states' obligations in the area of economic, social, and cultural rights. And it looks through tremendous amounts of jurisprudence in the International Court of Justice and other places to pull out what are the obligations of states outside of their own borders when it comes to economic and social rights. The first thing that it points out is that there's an obligation, a baseline obligation, to do no harm. In other words, that individual governments need to respect the human rights of others in other countries. The second thing that it does is point out that the duty to protect also has an international dimension, in particular where corporate or other private actors that are based in a country are violating human rights overseas. And finally, an obligation to support the fulfillment of economic and social rights overseas, commensurate with capacity and resources. This gets to the issues of development aid, but also creating the kind of conditions that are needed for economic and social rights fulfillment. All of this is very clearly defined, and that brings me to my second point. I respectfully disagree quite strongly that the human rights hasn't been clearly defined universally. We have six decades of jurisprudence in human rights at the domestic, regional, international level. These issues are very clearly defined over this time. And when it comes to the right to development, it's a good question because many have asked whether this can be clearly objectively assessed. And I want to point everyone to the report of the High Level Task Force on the Right to Development, which in 2010 came up with a comprehensive set of operational criteria and quantitative indicators to assess whether governments are conducting their policies in compliance with their domestic and international human rights obligations. They're clear, time-bound commitments that relate to domestic reforms as well as those cross-border impacts of government's policies. This all was left out in the Millennium Development Goals. We need to really make sure that these kind of international commitments are brought into the Sustainable Development Goals in a balanced way. Lastly, I just want to say that today has really confirmed for me that human rights post 2015 is not some kind of political lightning rod that many have thought it was. In fact, it's more of a kind of a magnetic force, providing norms and standards that are clearly defined internationally and universally to make the environmental, economic, and social dimensions and pillars of sustainable development more coherent and more convergent.
Thank you. May I invite another panelist to respond? Please, Mr. Stresser.
Thank you. Just two or three small remarks to what I heard here today. The first, I liked very much the picture the representative of Slovenia painted. The symphony has started, but is still not finished. What does it mean? I understood that he said, yes, what was done with the MDGs some years ago was a good idea to eradicate poverty and to make better the concrete situations of life for many people. But he said, and I think it's true, it was not fulfilled in all its branches, in all the things we had to fulfill, and therefore we need a new agenda. And now I think we should ask us what have been the mistakes. Why did it, in some parts of the eight development goals, why did it fail? And I think one of the points was that we made with the old discussion of the MDGs, we gave some good things to poor people. But we didn't give them the right to complain if they have not got these rights and not got this good. And therefore, I think the basic in the new debates on the post-MDGs and the new sustainable development goals must be this paradigm change to give the people who have the right, the human rights to develop, the human rights to have a life in dignity, to give them the rights to complain and to go to accept the rule of law and to give them all opportunities to take it. And therefore, I think it can't be, for me, it's no doubt that there is a very, very close connection between development goals and human rights and rule of law. And therefore, we have to implement, in my opinion, to all development goals that will be published and discussed in the next year, an instrumentum to implement for everybody who has the right to get this development goals for himself and in his society. What's true, and nobody, I heard nobody who had another opinion, that this is, in the first line, the job of the national governments. But what is when the national governments cannot take the responsibility? And I think we have to put instruments, and we have the instruments, because, as I know, all member countries of the United Nations ratified the two big human rights treaties many, many years ago, and therefore we need the instruments to implement this in the debate and in the discussion on the development goals. I think it both is one or two parts of the same medal, and therefore I'm very, very happy that here many ideas came up, especially I completely nearly agree with what you said about this context, and therefore I think we should work together that in 2015 this will be one of the consensus in the international community. I think this would be the best way to implement human rights and to give the rule of law the status that it has to have in all our debates since many years. And therefore, I think it was a very helpful discussion, and I thank all who took part in it and engaged, and I hope we can go on and make it in a good sense for the many people we are representing.
Thank you, Mr. Stresser. May I ask Martin Kreutner whether you would like to respond to what you have heard this morning?
Thank you very much, Madam Chairperson. There are two points that I would like to briefly reflect on. I do apologize, maybe being redundant, for some speakers already reflected on that. It strikes me that especially important is, as was just mentioned also by the previous speaker, is some kind of I'm hesitant calling it a review mechanism, though review mechanisms already within the UN system have also a success story to report, as the United Nations Convention Against Corruption implemented in 2009 a review mechanism. And to my understanding, and I think that most parties in the room would agree to that, though there was some reluctance at the beginning, this mechanism, in the meantime, is generally being called a success story. At the same time, I think it's important that it was also mentioned by some distinguished delegates that ultimately it's also about national ownership. I think this was mentioned by the distinguished delegate also of the European Union. However, also within the boundaries of states and international organizations, they may wish to implement something internally to scrutinize and to see the progress in implementing the sustainable development goals on the national basis. I took the liberty in my statement mentioning either Supreme Audit Commissions, independent anti-corruption authorities, or whatever that might be. The second point is, and also this brings me back to one point of my statement, is if we do not safeguard also the financial systems and the financing strategies to implement the goals and the achievements, we can sit here for the next decades and keep discussing. So I think it's equally important also to stress alternative ways of fundraising, alternative ways of safeguarding that we do have at hand the financial resources to implement those goals, be it still the MDGs or be it the Sustainable Development Goals. And here I think we are all called to go for these alternative ways. We know that in times of a financial crisis, regular budgets are pretty stressed. Again, we took the liberty of mentioning a few or sharing proposals on a few ones, like, for example, the Let Crime Pay principle or other ones as well. Thank you very much, Madam Chairperson.
Thank you, Mr. Kreitner. And finally, Madam Minister, I would like to give you the floor to respond to the comments.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. I think I should take this opportunity to thank all the contributors. I think we have had a very lively debate. And by and large, the debate has reinforced the belief that we have that we have over time developed concepts, ideas, norms of a universal nature. And when we are talking of development, really, we cannot say that this type of development, this level of development, is good for one part of the world or one part of the country, for that matter, and not for others. So surely what we're talking about here are universal values and universal goals, and this was very well articulated in the MDG, in the Millennium Declaration. Having said that, I should also wish to touch on the idea whether when we're talking of development, we're talking of sustainable development, linking it with human rights, rule of law, which one should come first. Really, all these go simultaneously. It would be unimaginable that a society would move to higher levels of development if they didn't have the basic rights, just a simple right to express themselves, a simple right to exist, to get registration. So surely these things are intertwined, and we have lived this in our own nations. We're not living in isolation. And when I look at my own country, Tanzania, I know that we developed these concepts well before the MDGs were known in the way they were known now. If you go to the records of the United Nations, you will find that the first president of the United Republic of Tanzania, President Nyerere, talked about poverty, talked about ignorance, talked about disease, the very things that we gave indicators for in the MDGs. And we have recognized our universal human rights. We know that human rights are indivisible, and so is their link to development. So I would really wish to take this opportunity to thank the interventions, and this, I should say, will reinforce our resolve to see that in the post-2015 development agenda, we have human rights, rule of law as very important for the carrying forward of the MDGs, but also for building a strong foundation for sustainable development. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Minister. One sentence each to the discussants, if you would like to sum up what you have heard.
Thank you, Chair. Just to kind of reiterate that human rights would, we missed out on looking at human rights in the, you know, MDG framework, and if we would do the mistake of leaving that and limiting it to looking at it just as a legal right, it would be a huge gap in terms of accomplishing what many of the panelists have already mentioned of, you know, ensuring a life of dignity for all. So, and also we, in terms of the Indian perspective that comes into this, we do think that it is very important to integrate the whole conversation around justice-based governance into the issue of human rights. Thank you.
I think for me it's the point that it's not a question of whether
For me, it's a point of not whether human rights apply in sustainable development, because I think, as been pointed out by the panelists, they clearly do, and they're very explicitly stated in the right to development, including civil and political rights. But it's about how we're going to apply them.
I would now like to thank the panelists and the discussants for the stimulating comments that they have made, and to all of you for contributing to this interactive debate. There are very important issues that have come up. There was a lot of statements supporting the need to integrate human rights and the rule of law and to take a people-centered approach to development, tackling inequalities, focusing on the most vulnerable and the marginalized. There were lots of statements supporting participation and accountability and the need to give a central role to human rights and the fight against discrimination and the eradication of poverty. The rule of law has been described as a powerful driver of development, both at the national, local, and international level, and in relation to all three dimensions of sustainable development. There has been a lot of emphasis put on open and accountable institutions, and indeed on the importance of resources to both ensure that resources are properly safeguarded for development and also that resources are made available for development. There have been concrete examples about legal identity, about gender justice, about access to justice. Of course, through this discussion, it has also become apparent that there will be, along the spectrum of development and along taking into account the diverse development histories, the culture of each country, there will be need to ensure appropriate acceptance of diversity as well as national ownership. The commonality of views should not mask that there are still gaps to close, there are still understandings to be developed and consensus to be built around many of these issues. And I think what we have benefited today has been from the multi-stakeholder approach of discussions human dignity is not indivisible, about the voice of civil society. We've heard the voice of business. And so from this collective voice, what we have also heard about impatience, let's finish the unfinished symphony, that human dignity is not indivisible, that there needs to be a paradigm shift. So indeed, we are here in the middle of a very interesting debate, and as one speaker has described the voices that are outside, waiting, people who are demanding something different, something transformative, something inspiring to take us forward post-2015, building on the lessons that we have learned from the past almost 15 years. This afternoon, I will have an opportunity in the closing session to properly summarize the comments. But now, before I close this session, Palestine would like to have the floor. If you could please limit yourself, in view of the time, to just 2 minutes. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for giving me the floor again. In response to the comment by the delegate of Israel, I would just like to state that everything in our statement regarding the rule of law, human rights, and development is accurate and is supported by various documents from the UN and NGOs, including Israeli NGOs, and would like to note that it is also disappointing that Israel, the occupying power, spoke to us yesterday about human rights for all, but continues to deny them to the Palestinian people. Thank you.
I would now like to bring to a close our panel discussion of this morning. And before I do that, there is a housekeeping announcement to make, and that is to draw your attention to the innovative approaches to advocate for child rights, which is being held in the conference room 22CB at 1:15, and lunch will also be served there. So let me thank you very much once again to all of you for a very interesting discussion, and to remind you also that the second panel discussion this afternoon, entitled Towards a Transformational Development Agenda, Integrating Human Rights and Rule of Law with a View to Improving Development Outcomes, will begin promptly at 3:00 in this chamber. The panel discussion one is now concluded. Thank you.